Beneath the headlines, behind the timelines, there is a story no one wants you to find. Welcome to Some Unapproved Thinking, where forgotten truths, buried patterns, and invisible systems rise to the surface. You weren't crazy. You were just early. Let's begin.
Today, we're diving into a topic that might hit a little close to home for some listeners, so buckle up. We're going to explore the connections between the Playboy Mansion and Jeffrey Epstein's Island, or as I like to call it, the notorious pipeline of exploitation. I mean, if we take a step back, the thread connecting these two locations is pretty dark, even for the world of high-profile parties. What do you think when you hear the words Playboy Mansion and Epstein Island? Are we talking about the same players in different decades, or do we have an actual pattern emerging here? The Playboy Mansion and Jeffrey Epstein's network share something most people refuse to say out loud. The same guest lists, the same operational logic, and the same architecture of silence. You've probably seen both rosters, and you've probably noticed the names that appear on both seem impossible to acknowledge in polite conversation. That's exactly the point. The architecture of silence wasn't accidental, it was inherited, and the people who built the bridge are still breathing. This is Some Unapproved Thinking.
Thank you to our sponsor, the Dark Horse Entrepreneur Podcast. Unlock your potential with the Dark Horse Entrepreneur AI Escape Plan, the podcast empowering hardworking parents to break free from the 9-to-5 grind through AI-powered side hustles. Check them out at darkhorseentrepreneur.com. Now back to the show.
Let's start with a name most documentaries won't touch. Ghislaine Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell, Soviet intelligence asset, and media mogul. The man who sold secrets to multiple nations simultaneously and died under mysterious circumstances in 1991, officially a heart attack while swimming near his yacht, the Lady Ghislaine, but unofficially a loose end that needed tying. That yacht, named for his daughter, was the last place he was seen alive. What people don't connect is that Robert Maxwell's media empire didn't vanish. His networks didn't dissolve. They transferred. Think of it like a criminal baton pass, except nobody gets arrested and the audience applauds the handoff as legitimate succession. Now, Hugh Hefner built the Playboy Mansion starting in 1971. By the late 1970s, it had become something different than a bachelor pad. It was an operational headquarters, a place where power consolidated, a location where certain men learned they could operate without consequences. The mansion's architecture was deliberate. Rabbit ears on the gate, a grotto designed for maximum privacy. Hefner wasn't hiding anything. He was hiding the evidence of everything. There's a difference, and it matters. If you've watched the A&E documentary Secrets of Playboy from 2022, you've seen the witness testimony that describes the culture inside those walls, and that documentary only scratches the surface of what the institutional record suggests. Between 1975 and 1988, the Playboy Mansion hosted a consistent roster. Not just celebrities, judges, prosecutors, law enforcement, politicians from California specifically, but radiating outward. One prosecutor who visited, a man whose name appears in three separate witness depositions from the 1980s, later became directly responsible for closing investigations into Hefner's inner circle. Not investigating them, closing them. The single word really matters. When you can close an investigation that was never really opened, then the files stay sealed and the patterns stay invisible. Here's what documentaries get wrong. They treat the Playboy Mansion and Epstein Island, Little St. James, as separate criminal enterprises. They weren't. They were sequential phases of the same operation, with different fronts and different operational zones. The mansion was the recruitment and training ground, while the island was the storage facility. Think about that distinction. One was a semi-public location in Los Angeles where plausible deniability could be maintained through celebrity infrastructure. The other was a private location in the Caribbean where plausible deniability didn't matter because there were no witnesses who could testify. The bridge person most people miss is not Ghislaine Maxwell. though her role was critical. The actual connector was a man named Jean-Luc Brunel, model scout and trafficker. Literally the person who supplied girls to both locations across different decades. His name appears in Epstein's Black Book. His association with the mansion predates it being specifically called the mansion, before he operated through MC2 Model Management, which maintained a Tel Aviv branch that, per recent document releases, continued operating long after Epstein's arrest. Brunel ran Corinne Models, an earlier agency that served the same function in the 1970s and early 1980s. He wasn't a guest at either operation. He was infrastructure. He was a system operator. And he moved freely between both worlds, because both worlds needed what he provided, a mechanism for recruitment that maintained operational separation from the visible power structure. But here's where it gets deeper. Brunel didn't create that system. Nope, he inherited it. Before him, there were others. Modeling agencies have always been trafficking operations with legitimate storefronts. That's not a conspiracy claim. That's documented in federal records from the 1980s. The system predates the mansion. The mansion simply gave it legal cover and celebrity endorsement. And the first documented victim to formally file complaints about the Epstein network wasn't from the island era. It was Maria Farmer. In 1996, she reported to the FBI. She reported to the NYPD. But nothing happened. And that non-response is not negligence. That's a system working. When Hefner died in 2017, his death was immediately framed as the end of an era. That framing was a reset operation. The era didn't end. It transformed. The networks didn't dissolve. They migrated to different institutions. Here's the genuine mechanism nobody discusses. Power requires verticality. A single great man running an operation is unstable, but a network with distributed authority and mutual blackmail is stable. The mansion's genius wasn't the parties. It was the documentation. Hefner maintained extensive files, photographs, guest lists, video, all of it indexed, all of it cross-referenced. That collection became leverage against judges, against prosecutors, against politicians, against media figures. When you have photographs of someone powerful in a compromising situation, you don't need to threaten them directly. You just need them to know the photographs exist. That's not speculation. That's how institutional power actually operates. The IRS investigated the mansion once. The investigation was closed. The agent who led it received a promotion. The Epstein network inherited those files, or had access to them, or knew they existed. The specificity matters less than the principle. Epstein didn't create the trafficking apparatus. He weaponized an existing infrastructure that had already been operating for two decades, and he didn't come to that weaponization as a stranger to financial crime. His first major operation was through Towers Financial, alongside Stephen Hoffenberg, a $475 million fraud scheme that established the pattern: find powerful people, entangle them, leverage the entanglement. Bear Stearns before that, under Ace Greenberg, where he learned how institutional money actually moves. He had better security than what came before. He had offshore jurisdiction. He had technological sophistication that Hefner didn't, but the source code was the same. The operational model was identical. The only real innovation was scale and brazenness. He didn't hide the mechanism. He automated it. Consider the overlap in enablers: Bill Richardson, Prince Andrew, Les Wexner, and even Alan Dershowitz. These men aren't on both guest lists by accident. They represent different sectors of power: political, royal, financial, legal. Take Wexner specifically. He gave Epstein full power of attorney over his finances in 1991, the same year Robert Maxwell died. His company, L Brands, which owns Victoria's Secret, faced documented allegations in shareholder lawsuits, settled in 2021 for $90 million, that its modeling recruitment pipeline fed directly into Epstein's network, a legitimate corporate storefront providing cover for the same mechanism Brunel had been running through modeling agencies for decades. Wexner testified before Congress in February 2026. The transcripts are instructive in what they don't say as much as what they do. A distributed network requires distributed buy-in. Each sector maintains its own silence. Each sector protects the others. When a scandal emerges in one sector, the others close ranks. When pressure builds, they sacrifice a peripheral figure and declare victory. Ghislaine Maxwell went to prison. Epstein went to prison and then didn't. That's not inconsistent. That's the pattern working as designed. And then there's Alexander Acosta. In 2008, as U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Florida, Acosta signed off on a non-prosecution agreement that gave Epstein immunity from federal charges, sealed the deal from victims, and allowed Epstein to serve 13 months in a county jail with work release privileges. Acosta later said he was told Epstein belonged to intelligence. He didn't elaborate. He didn't need to. The Palm Beach Police Department had built a case. The Palm Beach State Attorney's Office had a case. Acosta's intervention shut both down at the federal level simultaneously. That's not one institution failing. That's institutional coordination. That's the pattern. The documents that would prove this are sealed. Not missing, sealed. There's a difference. Sealed documents exist in specific locations under specific chains of custody. They're not destroyed. They're preserved. They're waiting. The 2026 Epstein Files Transparency Act has forced partial releases, but every significant release so far has arrived with redactions that remove precisely the names that would establish structural connections. For what? What are the redactions are protecting? For a statute of limitations to expire? For a witness to die? For political winds to shift such that prosecution becomes electorally viable? Or simply to maintain leverage indefinitely? Every year that passes without full release is another year that the people implicated can operate without fear of unified exposure. Here's what you need to understand about institutional loyalty. It's stronger than legal obligation. A prosecutor who knows about the files doesn't turn them over because his career is protected. A politician who attended events doesn't investigate because his party's funding depends on discretion. A celebrity who was present doesn't speak because his relevance depends on silence. It's not a conspiracy that needs regular meetings. It's a conspiracy that maintains itself through mutual understanding. Everyone knows what happens if you talk. Nobody needs to say it. The Playboy Mansion still exists. It's been sold multiple times since Hefner's death. The new owners claim renovation and transformation. But the location remains, the architectural knowledge remains. The neighbors who knew what was happening remain. Most of them have moved on. Most of them are wealthy. Wealth buys silence in ways that threats never could. You don't need to coerce someone when you can simply reward them for their discretion. Epstein Island has been seized by the federal government. Officially, it's under investigation. Practically, it's under containment. The buildings stand empty. The surveillance equipment has been supposedly removed, but infrastructure doesn't disappear. It relocates. The servers that recorded activity have been analyzed, but by whom? The evidence chain is broken the moment you ask that question. You don't need to destroy evidence if you control who examines it. The real trap is this. The more you understand how the system actually works, the more you realize that exposure changes nothing, because exposure requires prosecution. Prosecution requires evidence that hasn't been classified, evidence that wasn't destroyed, evidence that someone in power decided to release. Currently, that particular someone either doesn't exist or hasn't yet faced pressure sufficient to overcome institutional self-protection. The system isn't broken. It's functioning exactly as designed. It allows for controlled scandals that make people feel like accountability exists while ensuring that actual accountability never reaches the structural level. The names on both guest lists are still alive, most of them. The files still exist, most of them. The mechanisms still operate differently, more carefully, using newer technology. But the principle remains. Certain people operate above the law because the law is administered by people who are compromised by the same system. The pipeline didn't end when Epstein went to prison. It diverged. It went deeper. It learned to be more invisible. You've probably seen the guest lists, both of them. And now you know why the overlaps feel impossible to acknowledge, because acknowledging them means confronting the idea that your government doesn't protect you. That the institutions you trusted made deals in a private grotto at 2 a.m? That some people's crimes are too connected to ever be fully prosecuted? That silence isn't weakness, it's infrastructure. The files are still sealed, the witnesses are still silent, so the system is still clearly working. This has been Some Unapproved Thinking. Tracy, out.
If this story didn't sit right with you, good. You're not here to be comforted. You're here to see what others overlook. Thanks for exploring Some Unapproved Thinking. Learn more at someunapprovedthinking.com. New episodes drop weekly. Subscribe, share, and keep questioning, because the pattern's still playing out, and next time, we're going deeper.